It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. We had a question last week on our talkback segment about terrestrial snails. John from Hill City called, said his yard was alive with terrestrial snails. And I thought, well, this won't be too hard. I'll just go on the internet and find out all about terrestrial snails, and I'll tell John and all the rest of you everything there is to know about terrestrial snails. Well, it turns out that if you would like to become that expert, you can go on and do your study and get out and see what you can find about terrestrial snails, because there has not been a lot of research on snails in Minnesota. It says, and this is from a DNR page, the terrestrial gastropod fauna, that would be terrestrial snails, land snails of the Midwest, includes a number of the rarest animal taxa in North America. This fact was recognized as early as the late 1800s when the Pleistocene Hendersonia occulta was discovered alive along the Mississippi River Valley. And that was by a fellow who documented that in 1948. Since then, a number of Midwest endemics or rare endemics have been identified, and it goes on to name a bunch of them, which I will skip because most of them are quite difficult to ferret out the scientific name. Previous investigations into terrestrial gastropod biodiversity in the upper Midwest have been largely limited to the Paleozoic Plateau, that would be the Driftless Area, and the Iowan erosional surface in northeastern Iowa and the Black Hills of South Dakota, as these areas were beyond the limit of the Wisconsin glaciation, and they were presumed to be the only potential refuges for the glacial relict taxa. However, investigations made from 1995 to 98 from eastern Wisconsin to southern Ontario documented that these relics were not as geographically restricted as previously believed. Four habitats were found to harbor the bulk of important land snail species in this area. And there was a fellow by the name of Nicola who did the research in 96 and 98. Carbonate cliffs support populations of at least 17 rare Michigan and Wisconsin taxa, nine of which are likely glacial relics. The fauna of these sites, while bearing marked similarity to algific talus slope and moderate cliff sites of these Paleozoic plateau, are unique and support a higher frequency of northeastern species or beyond their normal range limits. Fens harbor the European disjunct Econulus alderi and the presumed glacial relics, and it goes on to list a bunch of them. All it tells me in reading this is that, this particular paragraph brings it out best, perhaps. This is particularly true in northeastern Minnesota, where anthropogenic impacts from forestry, recreation, and development are high. Almost nothing is known about the faunas associated with the west shore of Lake Superior. Holbricht, 1985, identified Minnesota as one of the most poorly known regions in the eastern U.S. for land snails. No species had previously been reported from Cook County, and only six have ever been recorded in a total from Lake and St. Louis counties. So, John, I am terribly sorry that I can't do much more than that. I guess I would encourage you to send me a photograph of one of these snails if you can, and I will try to pass it along to some others, and perhaps we can at least identify what it is you're looking at in your yard. But boy, anybody out there who's interested in maybe a master's degree or a PhD, it looks like snails could use some study here in northeastern Minnesota. It hasn't been all snails for me. This past week has been full of lots of interesting observations, including a mother otter who climbed out on a road in a kind of a swampy low spot. I didn't really expect there to be otters in there, but here comes this mother up on the road, and right behind her was another young one. And as I drove past, looked like there might have been a third otter in that group, so they were maybe out traveling about. Can't really say what they were doing, but definitely otters along the road, and that was always exciting. It is always exciting to see. Last Tuesday, yeah, about 7 o'clock in the evening, I saw a sundog on the southern side of the sun as it was setting, and it reminded me of the physics of sundogs, and just a possible short explanation here. The only time you see sundogs in the summertime is either very early in the morning or very late in the evening, because the sun has to be at a low angle in the sky in order for the little ice crystals to catch the sunlight and refract it as a rainbow. And this occurs, as I said, early morning, late evening in the summertime. In the wintertime, because the sun is at so much a lower angle in the sky, you can see sundogs almost any time of the day when the ice crystals are present. So, little sundog the other day, just a reminder that despite the heat, there are some signs of things that we generally see in the winter. You may recall last week I was talking about the month of August and some of the things that it would hold forth. And one of the things that I mentioned last week was the Carolina grasshopper. I talked about how it had the black wing with the white border or cream-colored border, which reminded me of the mourning cloak butterfly, except that the Carolina grasshopper folds its wings up like an accordion and has these sort of reddish-brown forewings or covering wings that cover these things, and they don't fly at all like a butterfly. I mean, they come up, they fly short distances, and then they land on the ground. If you've seen some Carolina grasshoppers, keep your eye on them. As we get further into the month, they will begin to hover. They'll fly up about 3 or 4 feet in the air and hover right in one spot. And I suspect that that has something to do with their courtship. But I'm not absolutely positive about that. So if you know more about them than I do, and that probably includes about half of you out there, why, send along a note. I'd like to know more about the Carolina grasshopper myself. False Solomon seal, a big plant of the woods, not big, 2-3 feet long and maybe 18 to 24 inches tall, has these clusters of gold berries at the end, and those gold berries, they're starting to get flecked with a little bit of red. So keep your eye out for the false Solomon seal berries in the woods. Canada thistle, boy, last Wednesday, I don't know if it was a combination of the wind and just the right time of year, but there were seeds flying everywhere. Canada thistle seeds were everywhere in the air that day. Fireweed, I mentioned the seed pods, which are the same color as the flowers and are starting to swell. Ed Dallas reports fireweed blooming down, or seeding, opening up, and seeds are popping out of the fireweed down in his neighborhood. I haven't seen it up here, but any day now I would expect that to happen. The asters continue to bloom. Of course, there are the big flat-topped asters, which are pretty easy to look at or find. The large-leafed aster, another easy one to find. The eastern-lined aster, or Aster lanceolatus, appears to be in bloom. Long, thin blades of leaves, very, very, very thin, like a quarter of an inch wide and maybe 3 or 4 inches long. And small blue flowers on those, finding them along the edges of lakes. A couple of butterflies have come to the eye lately. There are some monarchs around, and they are there are still some monarch caterpillars out there too, and they will be metamorphosing into the monarch butterflies that will be flying south here in another 2, 3, 4 weeks. Watch for big flocks of monarch butterflies moving south very soon. White admiral butterflies, lots of those around. Black butterfly with a big white border, I'm seeing them everywhere. Big populations of white admirals. I'm also looking at the clouded or common sulfur butterflies. There's lots of courtship activity that you can observe. Chase flights, where you'll see two of these yellow butterflies near a field somewhere, and they'll kind of fly up in a big spiral, and it's all about territory, and one of them is trying to drive the other one out of its territory. You can watch that. And my wife reported seeing clouded sulfur butterflies puddling, you know, sitting along the edges of water along the driveway. And this is a behavior that is common to a lot of butterflies, has to do with attracting minerals, sorting minerals out, the minerals that they need, that they require for copulation. The males puddle, they pick up these trace minerals, the minerals are valuable, and the females seem to be able to sense whether or not the male has a dowry of chemicals, minerals that they might like. And if that's the case, they will oftentimes select that male for mating, and he will pass along with his sperm, he will pass along this little packet of minerals that the female needs for her own life. So watch for puddling behavior among the butterflies. And it's not only the sulfurs that are going to be doing this, but the tiger swallowtails and the monarchs and all the rest of them. And sometimes it's puddles, sometimes it's animal scat. It can be a lot of different things, but they're out there searching for trace minerals that they require. I went out for a ride the other day, and just to show you how serendipity works, I was looking for pine sap. So I was riding my bike through my pine plantation, and the first thing I did was scare up a covey of about 5 young grouse. They were going every which way. It was quite exciting. The dogs didn't know which way to turn. Every time they turned to follow one, another one got up from the same spot and headed off in a different direction. So they were all running around kind of confused. And I kept riding down through the pine plantation, and I see this tall stem with a cluster of flowers at the top. And I thought, what the heck is that? And I got off my bike and looked at it, and it turns out that it was downy rattlesnake plantain. And I've never seen it before on my property. It's not an uncommon orchid, but certainly more rare than, say, the asters or the black-eyed Susans. But it grows in acid soils, and has this beautiful variegated leaf that is lovely to look at, and then the flowers are pretty nice as well. I will try and get a couple of the pictures that I took of that plant up on the internet in the next day or so that you can check it out. I saw my first flock of American crows this past week, and I also saw a flock of Canada geese flying, and that tells me that they are recovering from their eclipse molt. They go through a molt in the summertime where they are unable to fly, and now that appears to have passed, and they are out and practicing their flight techniques a little bit. So watch for flocks of geese again, and that will be happening more and more as we move through August and into September. Bottled gentian, closed gentian, is still blooming, probably at its peak of bloom. White turtlehead is still blooming, and that one is probably at its peak of bloom. And final note for this week, that little bald eagle, that little baby bald eagle that's been crying from the nest and crying and crying and crying for weeks and weeks and weeks, he finally is flying. He was over the house the other morning. Sunday morning, he circled the house and doing his little... He was still crying, but he was flying. And he found a little thermal there, and he took a ride up, and he got up fairly high. So he's maybe been flying for a week or so, but he's definitely testing all of his new equipment and finding out just how to control his wings and tail in the breeze. And it's fun to watch. Another successful year. That nest has been in operation since 1985. So this is 2010. What's that? 25 years. And in that time, they've produced young more often than not. I think of those 25 years, I think I have maybe 7 years when they didn't produce a baby or two. So they've been a successful nest. That's the Phenology Show for today. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, if you have observations to share, please send them along. It is time for TalkBack. TalkBack is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've got an observation you'd like to share, or a comment, or a question you'd like to pose. It doesn't matter. We're just waiting to hear from you, and you can get in touch with us by contacting us at our TalkBack line. That number is 999-9876. You can call that number and leave your message, or you can send us an email. The email address is comments@kaxe.org, or you can email me personally by sending emails to Jay Latimer, that's J-L-A-T-I-M-E-R, at kaxe.org. And, of course, you can always write to us. We love to get your letters, and the address is 260 Northeast 2nd Street, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 55744. And somebody took advantage of our postal system, put Dougie to work, and we got a nice letter from Jim. And Jim sent along a little picture, and he sent along this note. He said, "I came upon this plant on the south edge of our right-of-way near a small grove of birch trees and one 4-inch red pine in a kind of a grassy area. I would like more information on this plant, knowing there is not any chlorophyll in this plant. What family of plants does this belong to, and is it fairly common?" And the picture that Jim sent along is of Indian pipe, and there is no chlorophyll in Indian pipe. It is a saprophytic plant, I suppose, lives off of the energy created by some other plants and steals that energy, uses it for its own devices. In Jim's picture, the flower heads are pointing straight up, and that means that the plant has gone beyond its sort of blooming stage and is now in the process of turning into seeds, or making seeds in the flower head. And what you will have there is the whole plant will turn brown. When it starts off, it's a kind of a ghostly white, a really pure white. And if you look at the flower itself, you'll see a little pink in there. And then the whole thing turns, the flower head hangs down, sort of like a shepherd's crook. And then as it becomes fertilized, it will straighten up, and the flower head will turn straight up. And then the whole plant will turn brown, almost a coffee brown, very dark brown. But what you're looking at is Indian pipe, and it is fairly common, especially in acidic soils. If you are near a tree farm or a stand of pines, if you walk around under those pines just a little bit, it won't take you very long, and you'll find some Indian pipe. We got another letter from our friend Sam Guida, down in down near Gull Lake. He lives on Guida Lake, and he says, "Haven't written you for a while." We got a nice letter from his mother last week where she filled in for him. Had gone to Camp Olson through the end of July, now preparing to leave for Yellowstone, so probably won't hear from me for another 2 weeks. This week's report, bluebirds are gathering. The blooming plants include bergamot, blue vervain, jewelweed, and asters. Pumpkins are turning orange in the garden, and we are about to harvest all the sweet corn and process for freezing. Mink frogs are still calling. Our young osprey is now flying about and making lots of racket. We are down to one juvenile loon on Guida Lake. We had two at the beginning of the year. Crowsfoot grass has pollen hanging. With all the rain, there are lots of different mushrooms growing in the yards and woods, and green acorns are falling. Baby killdeer in our garden are almost as big as their mom. There are at least two of the three that hatched last spring, and we have given up on the great jelly due to bees, but the hummingbirds and orioles are draining the nectar feeder every day. That's all for now. That's from Sam over near Brainerd in the Crosby area. So thank you very much for that note, Sam. And finally, a note from Courtney. And Courtney is a member of the Itasca Birding Google group. And she sent along this note. "This morning I happened to notice a flock of birds in the trees by the driveway. Chickadees were hanging out with a Canada warbler, an oven bird, American redstart, black and white warbler, red-eyed vireo, chestnut-sided warbler, and one species I didn't see well enough to ID, a female something with a very bright yellow underside. In the alders out back, I observed a northern water thrush. As these birds are meandering south, our chipping sparrows are just getting ready to fledge a noisy brood from the Christmas trees. Foggy mornings during migration are fun. And if you'd like to get out and do some birding on your own, I encourage you to do so. There are lots of birds out there to check out, and this is a challenging time of year. The warblers are out there, and they all look quite similar. I took a brief walk with my mother the other day on the newly paved path that goes down to the Mississippi River on the south side of the river, and we saw a little Nashville warbler and some chipping sparrows and some trees over there. Ed Dallas reports from the Deerwood area that the grosbeak seemed to have abandoned his feeder. I still have a couple of females coming, but the males appear to have left the area. He also mentioned orioles and hummingbirds in large numbers at his hummingbird feeders. And Ed said that the first fireweed in the Deerwood area had gone to seed. I've been watching this fireweed fairly assiduously over the last couple of days. The pods, the seed pods, are the same color as the flowers. They're long, sort of thin pods that are exactly the same color as the flowers, and they will begin to pop open, and you'll see the white fluff of seeds that comes out of there. When the fireweed goes to seed, according to John Zazada and others who have lived in Alaska, that tells every native Alaskan that it'll be 6 weeks until the first snowfall. I think here at this latitude, we can expect a few more weeks before our first snowfall. But that would be, let's see, 6 weeks from today would be sort of the end of September. We have had snow as early as the end of September, but typically our first actual snowfall occurs sometime in the middle of October. We can wait. Even though it's going to be 90 degrees today, we can wait for that snowfall. It'll come altogether too soon, regardless of when it comes. That's our Talkback show for today. Tune in again next week, and by all means, send us a note from your neighborhood. We're anxious to hear what's going on where you live.
You're listening to Phenology Plus on KAXE, Community Radio for Northern Minnesota, 91.7 on the Iron Range, Whippolt, Warba, and Walker, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, 105.3 in Bemidji, audio streaming on the internet at KAXE.org. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer, and coming up, John talks with forester John Zazada about harvesting birch bark and ripening berries. Also, Eli Sagor previews the August edition of MyMinnesotaWoods.org, an online website with all kinds of information about the trees and forests of Minnesota. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Atchison Tire Company in Grand Rapids. Locally owned for more than 90 years, Atchison Tire has offered new tires and repair services for generations of their customers online at AtchisonTire.com. We also have support from the Bonner Eye Clinic in Grand Rapids. At the Bonner Eye Clinic, Doctors Bonner, Mariano, and Kincannon have served the eye care needs of Grand Rapids, Itasca County, and the Iron Range for over 45 years. Located at 1542 Golf Course Road, the Bonner Eye Clinic is proud to support KAXE, authentic local radio. Time now for a Talk on the Wild Side with John Latimer. And this evening, John's guest is retired forester John Zazada.
Well, John, it's always nice to have you with us. John Zazada is our guest. You were in Alaska.
I was, yeah.
And Ed Dallas remarked this morning that the fireweed had popped its first seed pod down by his house. And, of course, to an Alaskan, that means, what, 6 weeks till snow?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, they've had a summer that's as warm as ours up there this year.
I believe it.
It's just amazing. And, I was keeping track of the fireweed up there as I was there. And then when we got home, or I got home, it looked like it was about the same. And, this whole variability thing in phenology and development is just a never-ending source of fascination to me.
Yeah.
We often talk about phenology as just, well, the leaves are out. But as you well know, there's a lot of variability. And I think we don't often give that enough credit and keep track of it.
I have a contact over the internet, Johnny Lynn Burnett, who lives in West Virginia, and has a calendar out. And I look at the calendar, and this time of year, a lot of the things that are happening here are also happening there almost simultaneously. Joe pieweed comes to mind. Uh-huh. Now, I don't know if it's the same species. It's definitely the same genus, and their Joe pieweed seems to bloom about the same time ours does.
Yeah. One of the things that people that like to get birch bark kind of keep track of is the flowering of wild rose.
Oh, okay.
And you just think, well, Alaska's going to be way behind us, but oftentimes, and it's the same, I think the same species, their flowering of rose is right on or before ours. And they're about a half a degree south of the Arctic Circle.
Right.
But it's just fascinating anyway.
Speaking of wild rose and timing, I'm thinking about, 1st of June is about the time that we begin to see that wild rose happening here. So where were you in Alaska?
Well, I spent about a week and a half, 2 weeks in Fairbanks, and then 3-4 days in Talkeetna, and then a few days in Anchorage. And the purpose of the trip was to work with people on various birch bark type things. But probably the biggest block of time was helping out with an event called Week in the Woods. And this sort of thing, it's sponsored partly by the University of Alaska and just a group of interested people. They go out in the woods for a week, and they just kind of scrounge around looking for neat pieces of wood, birch bark, roots, and then they just build things, carve things by hand, and, get away from telephones. And, there's no... No iPods, cell phones allowed other than just for emergency purposes. And I think the age range was from 5 years old to 80 years old this year.
Wonderful.
And it was just real interesting. A lot of, just really talented people out there teaching one another this, that,
that
other thing.
I think is the most amazing thing. You get this interaction between all of those ages.
Yep.
And sometimes, you'd think, well, the older folks are going to be teaching the younger folks, but the 5-year-olds and this, those young kids, they have that sort of curiosity.
Yep.
That goes well beyond, we get familiar with things and we sort of dismiss them. Oh, I've seen that before. And it takes sometimes a 5-year-old to go down on his hands and knees and say, what's this? Or look at this. And it pulls you into a world that you haven't been to in 75 years.
Well, that's right. Yeah. In my case, I'm hung up on certain ways of using birch bark, but you give a 5-year-old a piece of birch bark for the first time, and you sort of think you're going to direct them into doing something, and all of a sudden whoa, where'd that kid get that idea? You know, it's wonderful. You know, they're not hung up on preconceived notions.
Yeah.
And it's a learning experience going both ways. You know?
I was out a week ago or so and had a birch that had, it was a conjoined at the trunk, and one of the two had broken off, and I was cutting it up to make firewood out of it. Mm-hmm. And the birch bark was very, very supple, and I wondered is this the time of year when a person would gather birch bark? Is this too late in the year? What was it about this birch bark? I mean, it was hard to split the wood because the birch bark, the bark itself, didn't want to break.
Yeah.
It was real stretchy, I guess.
Yeah. You know, the prime time when the outer bark comes off the easiest is, it can begin as early as early June and go as late as mid-July. At that time of the year, and even for a shorter period in there, you just make a vertical cut on the tree and the bark almost falls off.
Mm.
The tree. As you get to this time of year, the bark comes off harder. It's more difficult to take it off. But if you can get it off, you get a very different texture and color to the inner bark. It's called winter bark.
Oh.
And some artists that like to scratch patterns and stuff, you can scratch that deep brown layer off and make different kinds of figures, geometric animals, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this time of year and a little bit later and even on into the winter, if you can get that outer bark layer off the tree, it's quote unquote maybe more valuable than it is at the other time because of these different characteristics. So, but oftentimes the bark right now, like you're saying, it's just really stuck on the tree.
Yeah. Before we send a bunch of people into the woods with their pocket knives, what is the technique? What are the rules? How would a person, if they wanted to gather birch bark, how would they go about it?
Well, you know, the first rule should be, whose land am I on? you know, since I'm a forester, I kind of know how to attack this. And you know, people just need to go in or either know who the private landowner is or go in to county, state, feds and ask, where can I harvest birch bark? You know, and then once you do it, it's so simple that you know, you just use a utility knife and make a vertical cut on the tree. And
but you can do this without harming the tree, can't you?
Yeah, you can. And a new layer of bark will grow back. Very different than the original bark. But, yeah, and the Swedes that I've talked to say under their conditions that during the average life of a birch tree in Sweden, you can harvest the bark 3 times.
Oh.
You know, and, you know, whether that's true or not for here. But I have harvested what I call second growth bark off the trees.
Okay.
That the original bark was taken off, I don't know how long ago, but
how deep a cut are we making if we're going to do this?
You know, if you look at the total bark layer, which is made up of the inner bark and the outer bark is at most a fourth of the full bark layer.
Mm-hmm.
And probably less than that in the majority of time. So you're taking probably at most an eighth of the total bark layer. And if you want to maximize the possibility that tree is going to stay alive, you don't want to score all the way through to the wood. You just want to go through the outer bark and it'll just start to separate.
So like less than an eighth of an inch of blade would be plenty.
Yep.
Just enough to get through that outer layer.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're in an area that's going to get logged within a few weeks, it doesn't make any difference how deep you go.
Yeah, right. Are you going to be offering any classes coming up anytime soon about people or for people who might want to work with bark?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm going to Grand Marais this weekend, and then I think there's a class scheduled for October at McGrosty Arts Center. And, you know, if somebody wants to fool around with birch bark, give me a call. I'm happy to. I'm always monkeying around with it at home, so
yeah,
happy all to right. help.
So, you know, we're out there, and maybe we've been getting hot and sweaty, and we've been gathering some birch bark, but all of a sudden we stumble into a patch of berries. What's going on with the berries right now?
What's going on with the berries? Well, you know as well as I do, the thing that fascinates me, you know, and anybody that picks berries, wild berries, knows this, you know, is just the variation on one plant in the time that the berries ripen, you know.
Yeah.
I guess the ones that are most interesting to me right now, because they're the blackberries, and I've got a trail, half-mile trail around our land that I walk, you know, every day, and you know, the same bush I can pick half a dozen berries off, and the next day there's half a dozen or dozen more berries. And so it makes you wonder, well, you know, and I don't have the answers, you know, because it seems like the berries will be growing less than an inch from one another.
Yeah.
And one will be in an early stage of ripening, the other will be fully ripened, and so you pick one off, and the one that's almost touching it the next day, you know, turns from that kind of reddish to the black, and you know, what is it? What's going on? You know, is it timing of flowering? Is there some kind of hormonal thing that ripe berries are, you know, influencing less ripe berries? And it's just, you know, fascinating to watch.
When you do start thinking about it, I agree. It is fascinating, because you know, if you could know when that particular blossom was pollinated,
yeah.
is there a number? Is it 33 days till it's ripe, or is it, as you say, is it hormonal? Is there something in the plant that says, okay, you know, to maximize the opportunity to spread my seed, I need to stagger my fruiting.
Yeah.
And does the plant have some control over that? I don't think I've never seen any research on that.
I'm sure somebody's monkeying around with, especially the horticulturists, you know, that try to breed for kind of a mass ripening all
yeah,
at once.
So a uniformity.
You go out there and you just pick all the crop and you're done.
Right.
You know, I mean, they...
Blueberry growers, cranberry growers, those kind of people would be interested in that sort of...
And there's a huge advantage to that.
Oh, sure.
You know, for commercial purposes, but there's, you know, even a bigger advantage to the plant in nature to spread that whole thing out.
And, you bet.
Yeah, you mentioned Ed Dallas seeing the fireweed seed dispersed down there. And years ago, I collected fireweed seed throughout this dispersal period, and it seemed like, you know, the seeds that are dispersed at this time are less dormant than seeds that are dispersed, say, at the very end of the seed dispersal period in fireweed. So that if, you know, the seeds right now, if they meet the right conditions, they may germinate, whereas the seeds that are dispersed later in September, they may lay dormant for a longer period of time. And I think, you know, this goes on throughout the plant kingdom, that you have, you know, this variability in ripening that we see extends to the variability that you might see in the actual germination and growth of the seedling, you know, later on. And I think this is pretty well known. It just, you know, fascinates me to see how, you know, we think plants don't have, it just sort of happens, but there's a lot of controls going on in there that, you know, they know something about, but not as much as we'd like to know.
Yeah. Yesterday's Time magazine cover was about intelligence in animals, and they're discovering that animals are a lot smarter than people gave them credit for being. And I think the same thing might be true of plants. I think that may be the next discovery, is that these plants are a lot smarter, or at least they're a lot more attuned to survival than we give them credit for. And I think some of that survival comes from this, you know, this kind of staggering of ripeness, this dormancy of seeds. And I think that they prepare for a lot of different contingencies that we may not even be aware of.
Yeah, I think, you know, another thing that that I've just read a little bit about, and maybe you've seen too, is some of these population things that are going on when an infestation of, you know, a certain insect, regardless of what it is, you know, attacks some trees, they give off some sort of chemical trigger that allows or, you know, triggers a response in neighboring trees to sort of, you got to build up your defense, you know, so that these guys don't get you too.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that you've got communication going on with individual plants, but, you know, according to this research, you've got communication going on across the stand of trees, which, whoa, you know, I mean, that's pretty
right.
Cool stuff.
We can't,
you know,
hear them talking to one another, but they're definitely passing the word.
It seems to be, and yeah, that would be an interesting topic to, you know, get somebody on someday to talk about communication between plants within a population.
John Zazada is a retired forester and birch bark artist from Grand Rapids. Time now to find out what's new at myminnesotawoods.org. It's a website full of information for anyone interested in Minnesota's forests and trees. Eli Sagor is a forester with the University of Minnesota Extension Service, and he previews myminnesotawoods.org with us each month. One thing I really appreciate about myminnesotawoods.org is we can ask questions, we can get information there just by going online, and I particularly appreciate one of the lead stories this month, What's Wrong With Your Tree? Questions from tree owners about problems they're noticing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's just a great resource. Jeff Hahn is an entomologist down here on the St. Paul campus. Michelle Grabowski with Extension and a couple of others have pulled together. It's kind of like a dichotomous key for those of your listeners who have used those. That's something you would usually use to identify a plant. And it's the same idea here, except it's online, and it's something that you would do to identify an insect or a disease problem that's affecting your trees. So, and it really is a great resource. It's called What's Wrong With My Plant, and it covers vegetables, fruit, turf, variety of things. Of most interest, I think, to My Minnesota Woods readers are the two sections on deciduous trees, shrubs, and vines, and then a smaller section that they're still building on evergreen trees and shrubs. But it's just a real nice resource. You can go in, you just click through, you click deciduous trees, you get a long list of species. You can click on whatever species you're interested in, whatever tree or shrub species, and then you'll get a variety of options from there. Is it a leaf spot disease? Is it affecting the trunk or the leaves or the branches? And it's really pretty interactive. You don't have to be, you don't have to have a PhD to work your way through this thing. They don't use big scary words and all that. It's real pretty interactive. Lots of photos to help you identify it. So we're excited about that. It's something that they released. It's been up. The What's Wrong With My Plant part of it has been up for a while, but they've really done a lot of expansion on the trees and shrubs. And in fact, right now, and I want to mention this, it's. I said earlier that the section on evergreens, conifers, is really pretty limited right now. They only have four species, and they are actively building that, and in fact, they have a call out right now. They want to hear from landowners and homeowners and others as to what species they're most interested in, and if they're going to build new sections of this site, what species should they focus on? Should it be white pine, red pine, spruces, or something else? So, if any KAXE listeners have suggestions for that, if you're seeing a lot of problems on a certain species and those problems are not covered on this resource, we'd love to hear from you. Folks can just drop me a line through the website or post a comment on the site or the discussion board, whatever's easiest for them, and I'd be happy to forward it along. So just a real good resource out there for folks who are concerned about insect and disease problems that they see in their woods.
All right, Eli. Well, I just noticed something this week. You know, this is one of the first summers I can remember, at least in recent years, when we haven't been concerned about drought on our the health of our trees, because we've had pretty good rain amounts all summer long. But I did notice on a bur oak in my yard, the leaves, the full healthy leaves, are now starting to curl, and they've got this brown crusty stuff on them. Is there any reason to be concerned about that?
Well, it could be a number of things, and that's exactly the kind of thing that this resource would help you to identify. I thought you were going to talk about the galls. I have a few bur oaks in my yard, and a lot of folks are seeing those big galls. They're created by what are called cinnipid wasps that lay their eggs inside the stem of bur oaks and create these galls. In general, leaf spot diseases really are not serious problems. They look bad, they are kind of frightening sometimes, but they're usually not too much of a problem. And so I wouldn't worry too much about those. Folks often recommend, if you do have a tree that's particularly badly affected by a leaf spot disease, think about when the leaves fall, raking those up and getting rid of them if it's a yard tree or if that's convenient for you to do. Otherwise, just don't worry about it. Leaf spot diseases are, of course, more common. They're typically fungal diseases, so the outbreaks can be a little bit more intense during moist, wet years like this one. If next year is drier, then I would expect to see less of the, fewer symptoms of leaf spot diseases. So, no, it's not something I would worry too much about.
Kind of an ominous article headline in this month's edition of MyMinnesotaWoods.org. It's called Planning for a Future Without Ash. And one thing I learned there is that Minnesota now has more ash trees than any other state because that emerald ash borer has devastated the ash trees in Michigan. But how do you plan for a future without ash?
Well, that's an article, just a short article that Angie Gupta wrote. She is an extension educator down in Rochester. And basically what she's getting at is that this bug is coming. And emerald ash borer kills every tree that it gets into unless that tree is treated. There are a couple of individual tree treatments that you can hire an arborist to do, or some of those you can do yourself. But that's really not practical on more than a couple of trees, a yard tree here or there. And so what Angie's getting at, Angie deals mostly with woodland situations as opposed to yard trees, and she's thinking about how our woods are going to change and what landowners can do. The recommendations that you list in this article are things like think outside the box, think about a wider choice of tree species, consider planting shade-tolerant trees beneath canopies of existing ash trees. So if you've got a big ash stand out in your woods, think about diversifying that stand. We've seen a fair bit of ash decline in recent years as well, so some of those stands are already beginning to break up a little bit. Thinking about getting some other species planted underneath there is a good idea. And again, just kind of diversifying those stands, because it's not just emerald ash borer. I mean, Angie mentions Asian longhorn beetle, which kills maple, another kind of demoralizing species that's established in the U.S. now, although not here in Minnesota. These things are coming. So really what Angie focuses on in this article is just making sure that you have a variety of different tree species out on your land in order to kind of hedge your bets. And if a bug comes along or something changes and that takes out most of the trees of one species, you'll have others there as well. And it's not just species. It's also age classes. And so really trying to maintain diverse ages and species on your land is a good idea. And Scott, while we're on that topic, I just want to quickly mention something. There's another project that I'm working on now that I think we're going to hear more about on the website and that you and I may discuss in coming months. We've been doing videotaped interviews with a few loggers out in the woods. Cheryl Adams with UPM Blandin Paper Company in Grand Rapids and Dave Chura with the Minnesota Logger Education Program were just out a couple of weeks ago talking about intermediate stand treatments. And when we talk about diversifying stands and we talk about active management, things that you can do to make your stands more resilient to insect outbreaks and disease and other changes, those intermediate treatments are a really great way to increase the vigor and health and productivity of those stands. So I look forward to continuing to work on that. We'll probably have a video on that topic ready to go in a month or so. And you and I just might be talking about intermediate stand treatments, too.
Say you're profiling your MFA member, Minnesota Forestry Association members, every month. And your profile this month, some good friends of KAXE, Jim and Sally Columbus. I know they have a woodlot right in town here. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, sure. Jim is a woodland advisor. I got to know Jim back in 2001 or 2002 when we offered the woodland advisor training over a course of a five-week period right in Grand Rapids. It was just a great group of people. Bob Sonnenberg was a member of that same cohort. Bob was, just a few weeks ago, represented the North Central United States as the tree farmer, outstanding tree farmer of the year, one of four landowners, tree farmers from around the country that competed for the National Outstanding Tree Farmer of the Year Award. So Bob's a great guy. Current MFA President John O'Reilly, MFA Board Member Jim Hunter. So that was just a great group that went through there. And this article on Jim and Sally was written by John O'Reilly, and it's just a nice article, you know, and really kind of emphasizes this idea that you don't have to own 350 acres or whatever out in the woods to be an active and interested woodland manager. Jim and Sally own a small parcel, just an acre or two, on a lake in Itasca County, not far from Grand Rapids. They talk here in the article about their contribution that they recently made to the Gillette Children's Hospital through the Log a Load for Kids program. And just a variety of things that Jim's been doing. So Jim really is one of these real active landowners in Itasca County, someone who is very actively, you know, talking to his neighbors, trying to get information out about good, sustainable forest management, really an asset to the community up there.
All right, Eli, it won't be too long before fall's here. It doesn't feel like it these days with our hot weather, but that means more events, more opportunities for people who have woodlots or people want to know more to go to workshops and things like that. What do you want to highlight this month?
Well, a few different things are coming up. There's going to be a field day held in Pequot Lakes, north of Brainerd, on September 25th, organized by the Central Minnesota Small Woodlot Owners. A couple of other events, intergenerational land transfer down in Cloquet, beginning in late September. That's a two-part session, so the first gathering is September 30th, and I think the second one is 3 to 4 weeks later, also down in Cloquet. A lot of those classes are offered as Woodland Advisor Program classes. I mentioned that Jim Columbus is a Woodland Advisor. That means he's completed this five-week training program and now is an active volunteer sharing what he knows with his neighbors. And in this month's email, we have a report on the Woodland Advisor Program and what's been accomplished over the last year. About 800 people came to 60-65 classes last year. We try to keep the classes kind of small so folks have time to ask questions and make sure that they're, the things they're interested in get out. And one of the things we're real pleased to announce is that all those volunteer activities, the kinds of things we were talking about Jim Columbus and all those other folks doing, have added up to a very conservative estimate of at least about $100,000 of public value if you add up all that volunteer time. And so those folks really are, as I said earlier, assets to their community, and we're excited to share some of those results through that Woodland Advisor annual report. The class calendar right now is a little bit sparse. It's summer. There's not a whole lot going on, but as you said, when the weather turns a little cooler, when people are back from the cabin and kind of a little more settled at home during the fall and winter, that's when the workshops really pick up. So I expect over the next couple months we'll have a little bit more to report.
Okay. And finally, we always talk about the discussion board when we visit with you, and tell us why it's there and how it works.
Yeah, well, you mentioned earlier that's, the interaction that happens on the site is really one of the best parts of it. And I say this almost every month. I really agree. There's a lot of good information out there this month on the discussion board. We had a few things posted on the discussion board, but also a number of comments just kind of spread around the site. In mid-July, July 15th, we changed the oak wilt risk status from high to low. There's been a lot of questions and a lot of interest on that. What do you do if your tree has a recent wound? Should you paint over that? Should you just let it go? Should you clean up the wound? How do you handle that? So there's the oak wilt page has a question on that. A bunch of other questions about how to deal with hazard trees near a house, what to do about a silver maple with a large crack in it, just a variety of things on the discussion board. And that discussion board is divided up into seven or eight different categories: insect and disease, agroforestry, woodland care and management, legal and financial issues, non-timber forest products, and a variety of other things there. So a lot of good questions and good answers coming in from our readers as well.
It's all at MyMinnesotaWoods.org, a website for people interested in Minnesota forests and trees, especially geared for woodlot owners, too, and the people who have questions about our trees and forests. Eli Sager's an extension educator with the University of Minnesota. Thanks again, Eli. Good to visit with you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Itasca Surgical Clinic in Grand Rapids. At the Itasca Surgical Clinic, patients are provided with personal screening, diagnosis, and treatment of a full range of medical conditions, all in a caring environment. We also have support from Dale's Auto Body of Grand Rapids. For over 25 years, Dale's Auto Body has offered a facility where repairs are done by professionals to factory specifications. Dale's also offers Permatex spray-on bed liner, the next generation of spray-on liners. Dale's Auto Body strives to meet and exceed customer expectations. Campers are reminded there's a state law that prohibits bringing firewood into state parks and forests. Transportation of firewood's been directly linked to the spread of the emerald ash borer. That tiny insect has already killed millions of ash trees in the upper Midwest and is moving our way. Campers should purchase firewood from local vendors in and around state, federal, and county forests and parks. There'll be a program about Minnesota white-tailed deer tomorrow evening from 7 to 8 o'clock at Bearhead State Park near Ely. DNR wildlife biologists will explain the biology, population status, and current research on the white-tailed deer. There's no fee for the program, but all vehicles entering the park must have a current state park permit. And the Edge of the Wilderness Discovery Center in Marcell has naturalist programs every Wednesday and Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock throughout the summer. Programs cover a variety of topics like Ojibwe history, wildflowers, bears, birds, wolves, wild berries, and bogs. For more information about the program's schedule, call KAXE 218-326-1234. That's Phenology Plus for this Tuesday evening. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Thanks for listening.